It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Okay, once again, we were talking to Jasper from Commune Magazine. We talked a while back about student struggles. We're going to be talking now about the economic impact of the coronavirus, just this ensuing meltdown that's really changed all of our lives and really leaves a lot of big, important questions, I feel like. So we wanted to talk with Jasper, pick his brain. But just kind of out the gate, how would you describe what's happening in the U.S. and across the world right now in terms of the effect of this thing on the global economic system? I mean, is there another time that we can look to that's kind of similar, or is this just something that's completely new?
Well, I can't really think of anything else like it. I guess it's similar to the effect that wars have had on economies. So, you know, it looks something like, a war economy. But as a crisis of the capitalist system, the way that it has unfolded is pretty unique, or at least it seems so to me. I mean, typically when you have a crisis in capitalism, it's because, employers don't have resources, capital, or access to certain kinds of goods. And then they, you know, shut down. They shut down, or there's no demand. And then the corporation shut down for that reason, and the kind of a wave of bankruptcies unfolds through the capitalist system. But here what happened is that, the virus made it impossible for, they had plenty of capital, but the virus made it impossible for, you know, firms to get access to workers and for firms to be able to sell things, to consumers, and also to access raw materials. And that's why, you know, that's the effect that it produces, is it, you know, keeps everybody at home and makes it impossible for them to go to work. And so it's almost kind of like a strike in that sense. And I think Shuang had a piece that drew out that dimension of it, because it's kind of removing labor from the economy, just as a strike does. You know, it's something like these kinds of moments in antiquity where you would have this you know, secession of the people, and everybody would withdraw from the city and go to the hills, and the kind of economy would collapse, and the ruling class would have to come and kind of bargain with the people. It's something like that, except it's been forced on everyone by the virus. But that's, you know, that's the shape of it. And, you know, we're seeing how fragile our economy really is, and how much it depends on these particular infusions of labor, and how much it depends on people showing up in these places, restaurants, bars, coffee shops, you know, getting into Ubers, etc., in order to keep functioning, right? The virus has targeted all of that. It's targeted, the major area in growth in the United States, which has been in the kind of the service sector. Some tech work can still go on, but, you know, it's just made it impossible for the entire U.S. service sector to exist. And, you know, where I live, it feels like, you know, maybe half of the people I know have lost their job in the last 2 weeks. It's just astounding. And that's, you know, where all of the growth is. Everyone I know, you know, works in that sector because those are the jobs that are available. So, I mean, it's quite astounding. And I don't really know if there's a speed at which jobs are disappearing is likely to be unprecedented. I don't even think that the Great Depression after the 1929 crash was this fast. So it's really astounding, and the amount of kind of misery that is being forced on people right now is just staggering. And it's not as if people's lives were great before this. So it's, you know, my head is still really spinning, and, you know, and I think everybody's head is still spinning. You know, we're trapped in our houses with our heads spinning, or, you know, if we're lucky to have a place to be, if you're lucky enough, yeah. To, you know, be.
For sure. Well, let's talk about this real quick, because I feel like this will kind of impact the rest of our discussion. But in the last couple of days, there's been a real kind of shift in rhetoric with the Trump administration. Also, like, talking heads, which kind of have the ear of the president, like Tucker Carlson. And they've really kind of pushed this line that, you know, we need to return to normalcy. And there's also been, like, some talk of, like, it is acceptable that some people will die. And for the economy to basically be rebooted. And that's something that's been echoed in, like, I've seen it in, like, the British press, also in the American press. There's been people saying this, but I'm just kind of curious, what does this mean? Like, when Trump is saying that, like, we've got to restart the economy in, like, 4 weeks, but most people are saying, like, we're about to enter into a period in which we're going to be seeing things like we're seeing in Italy, where just, like, an enormous spike in infections. The hospitals are just filling up with people. We may not have enough infrastructure. I know in California, that the governor there is, like, you know, trying to get more beds and more infrastructure in hospitals and stuff like that. They're, like, even working with, like, people like Elon Musk to get, like, different equipment and things like that. So what does it mean that Trump is saying we're going to go back to work in a month and other people are basically preparing for Armageddon?
Well, I mean, I think it means that the entire ruling class, the people who make decisions that affect our lives in this country, is really on the back foot and reacting in different kinds of ways and with different kinds of information, because, you know, they're really in an untenable position, especially Trump, right? Whose chance of reelection is at stake, and who has to kind of balance, you know, fighting the virus with keeping the economy alive. And that's not, those two things really aren't, it's probably not going to be possible to do both. So I wouldn't put too much stock in whatever Trump says today, because as you note, you know, cases are going to explode, and, you know, his reaction today is not likely to be his reaction 2 weeks from now, when he would make any decision about going back to work and, you know, sending people back to work. And I know he's already signaling that he's really going to do that. But note that he already has, you know, changed his position 3 or 4 times. There's clearly an incredible amount of disorganization within the executive and just absolute dysfunction. They have no capacity to kind of respond to this crisis, to get resources anywhere, to, you know, manage testing. And that set of responsibilities has really fallen to the states. And so I think we're going to see something very interesting where the states and the federal government are just, you know, operating on different kinds of tracks. And large corporations are going to be kind of acting autonomously and independently, as we already saw. Many of them were canceling, you know, going to telework before there were any explicit kind of orders to shelter in place. So we're going to see something really, really weird. And I think that the ruling class is going to be extraordinarily divided. But that's a problem, because, you know, those kinds of divisions can produce divisions within emancipatory forces too, right? And so, you know, I think that we just need to be really careful about understanding that, and, you know, understanding those divisions and understanding what's at stake, which is not just, you know, not just, how we kind of mitigate the consequences of the virus, but a whole set of kind of political and economic questions that have to do with people's freedom and their ability to survive and eat in this moment and, you know, going forward into an economic Great Depression. In which the state, you know, seems ready to do anything. Suspend habeas corpus, send armies to patrol the streets, force us to go back to work. I mean, it could get so weird so quickly. And I think it's just really important for everybody to keep that in mind. You know, is there going to be a watch on even?
I was going to say, can you speak a little more to the divisions you see either economically or politically within the ruling elites? I think that's a really important point to make. I mean, what kind of divisions are you seeing play out, just in terms of either one side wanting people to go back to work as soon as possible and another side?
I think that's quite possible. You could see kind of, you know, Trump setting up against Newsom and Cuomo, right, who are kind of, dealing with exploding epidemics in California and New York. In 2 weeks, we're going to be seeing peaking cases, at least definitely in New York and probably in California too. And, so you could see a situation where Trump is kind of trying to get, you know, the country back to work, and they're openly opposing him. Where that goes from there. The United States is a federalist system, and the division of powers between the states and the federal government, you know, has always been a source of potential unrest, and that's the way that civil war would play out in the United States. And I don't find those scenarios inconceivable at this point. It's too early to really, you know, talk about them, but I think people should keep them in mind.
Yeah, for sure. Well, one thing I wanted to ask, there's been a lot of comparisons to the 2008 crash. I know we talked about that this is kind of an unprecedented thing, but I'm just curious, how would you compare it to that crisis, 10 or 12 years ago? And also, what do you think we can expect to see kind of as this thing plays out?
Well, that's a great, that's the big question. I don't know that the federal government is throwing a lot of tools at the financial, throwing a lot of kind of money at the financial system and using the same kinds of weapons that it used in 2008. It's giving credit, free money to all of the banks that need it in order to kind of keep lending going. And then it's buying up damaged debt. In this case, it's mostly corporate debt that they are targeting, because now it's the kind of corporate debt sector, corporate bonds, that are really one of the weakest links in the economy. But they're also setting up to be able to buy consumer debt, car, auto loans, and credit card debt that's been bundled and packed into those kinds of asset-backed securities that were the source of the 2008 crisis. Now, that was largely in the housing sector with mortgage-backed securities, and there's not that much of this kind of debt. So now we're likely to see it unfold in the kind of corporate debt sector and in other places. Obviously, student loans and student debt is a huge area where things could really start to blow up. And it's similar to the 2008 crisis in that, right now, all of these people have lost jobs. They suddenly don't have money. They can't pay their rent, but they also can't pay down their debt. And there's banks that are dependent upon that stream of money coming in as people pay down their debt. And as that money doesn't come in, that reverberates through the financial system. And because the financial system is so tightly interlinked, a bit of money not coming in can really send shockwaves. So that's just one of the things that's happening. But then there's also the fact that, even firms that can get their goods out to workers and are still, have plenty of money, they can't even get access to labor because the parts of the economy are shut down. And that's the thing that Trump is worried about, is that you can pour money into the economy, but if people are on lockdown conditions and you can't get, workers to the work site, that money isn't useful because you can't do anything with it. And that's the nature of the capitalist economy, is that, workers have to be exploited. And just throwing money, dumping money on the economy isn't necessarily going to solve this problem if you have a situation, a health crisis, in which people can't gather in the workplace. That's how this is really different. It's bigger, and you can see they're already just throwing so many things at us. I made a joke with somebody the other day that it feels like that people are able to win kind of more reforms today, just locked up in their houses, than they were able to kind of win in, years and years of taking to the streets. And, it's like we have this power just because of what the virus has done to the economy from behind our keyboards, and so we need to be careful too, because it's kind of like a lot of the demands that are coming out are already being, well received by people in power. So there's a lot of possibility of kind of those demands getting recuperated and watered down. None of that was happening in 2008. They didn't do anything but bail out the banks, for years, right? And then that eventually produced Occupy. This is different, right? Because the need is so, so great. And the amount of labor and spending power that's been removed from the economy in a course of 2 weeks is just so massive that they're just pulling out all the stops. I mean, they're even they're talking about wild things that were like dreamed up by modern monetary theory nerds on, you know, Facebook groups are now being, you know, put into bills.
Yeah, they're like bringing Andrew Yang to the White House to talk about UBI.
Yeah, it's so nuts. Really, you know, anything is possible. So we really just have to keep on top of it and pay attention to this stuff.
Well, I think this begs the question, you know, with Trump pumping like $1.5 trillion into the Fed, and then they're also talking about doing all these bailouts, and then there's, you know, they have a couple like different schemes, like, you know, we'll do income tax cuts, but that will really be like a cut on Social Security. There's some talk that there's going to be some sort of either like a one-time UBI type thing, or like a stipend that's going to be given to people. But I'm just curious, I mean, do you see that, any of that, mostly the stuff they're going to do for the, you know, into the economy, does that, would that have any effect at all?
It depends on what you're talking about. You know, each of those things that you mentioned is going to have a different effect, and it's going to have a different effect for different people. And, you know, it's a question of what you're trying to do. If you're trying to keep share prices up, and prevent a collapse in the value of different kinds of assets, then it's fine to just dump money into the hands of rich people. But it's not necessarily going to treat the underlying problem, which is this lack of access to labor and stores not having access to people purchasing their things. And people not having money to purchase stuff. So, you know, to treat those problems, you have to do particular kinds of things. And you have to get money into people's hands. So things like the UBI are going to be more effective. But yeah, if you bail out the airlines, you know, it doesn't matter because no one's flying. The airlines are, all you're doing is keeping them from, you know, keeping them, making them able to kind of meet their bills on a month-to-month basis and stay alive until maybe, you know, the air industry can come back after this is all over. But that's just absurd. You know, let the airlines die. The airlines dying would probably be the greatest outcome of this crisis. I mean, the air travel, I love to fly. You know, I like to be able to travel to other places. And, you know, there's some traveling I'd like to be able to do in my lifetime, even though I'm traveling less and saying no to a lot of things for a bunch of reasons. But one of them being that it spews a lot of carbon into the air. But, you know, if the airlines were destroyed, that would give us such a kind of, you know, foot up in the fight against climate change, really. So, you know, definitely we should be laughing at any kind of bailout for those kinds of industries. We should let them burn. Not that we have the power to do that, but really just pouring money into the, you know, airlines when nobody is flying is just, yeah, it's just keeping the value of the assets that wealthy people hold afloat. And it won't work because, you know, eventually the underlying fact that people aren't flying is going to assert itself.
So now turning to, you know, there's some reports that unemployment is going to go as high as 30% or more. I mean, this is coming from, you know, the Trump administration. With so many people living paycheck to paycheck already, what do you see happening? Like when those checks, you know, really start to run out? I mean, we're seeing this kind of at the start of next month. It's going to get worse in May. I'm just curious, you know, what kinds of things do you expect to see as this process really plays out?
I mean, I think unemployment of 30% or higher is certainly going to happen. Like I said, I mean, especially in a place like the Bay Area, you know, if I think about the transformation of the economy here and the transformation of people's lives, you know, the two most significant things that have happened is that rent has increased, but also there's been an abundance of service sector jobs. And, you know, you can always find work, in some kind of, you know, in-person service job, whether working in restaurants or bars or coffee shops or whatnot. And, you know, and everybody's doing that out here. most people I know are, you know, working all the time to be able to make their rent. And now suddenly those jobs don't exist. So, I mean, here among the people I know, it's just, you know, it's just going to be an immense crisis. None of them can pay their rent. Now, my partner is a Pilates instructor. You know, she can't work, but that's the case for, you know, most of the people I know. And, so yeah, I mean, they're just simply not, people are just simply not going to be able to, pay their rent and pay their bills. And the question is, you know, how that incapacity is going to be kind of organized and turned into kind of a force that can be used against, you know, the powers that be. So, you know, I think that's the conversation everybody's happening. You know, do you call it a rent strike? Do you try to organize it as a rent strike and build it into something bigger? This, you know, incapacity, this inability to pay. You know, I think it's gonna unfold slowly. You know, some people will be able to pay on April 1st. People aren't really living paycheck to paycheck, right? You know, some bills people will be able to pay. They're still getting paychecks. They maybe get a little bit of sick pay, whatnot. But, you know, as this goes on in April and into May, I think that, you know, there's no way that the whole kind of system of landlordage can continue. I mean, that's the majority of the kind of income that people are earning goes straight to their landlords. That's just unsustainable.
Yeah, I even saw one article today that was saying that retail companies were going to, were issuing a statement saying they were going to stop paying their rent to, you know, mortgage brokers or whatever. And I know, I think banks like Fannie Mae have even said that they're willing to basically work with, people that like own multiple homes, you know, landlords basically, in order to, you know, help them mitigate the impact of not having rent come in. So, I mean, it seems like they're already bracing for kind of like a suspension of rent in some ways.
They have to renegotiate rent with the renting class, as it were, right? I mean, you can think about it almost this way. This is sort of crude, right? But, you know, we have the stock market. It's going up. You know, in 2008, it went down to something like 8,000, I think, or maybe it was 7,000. But it was down really low. And now, you know, it's been way up above 20, and now it's below 20. And if you can think about the value of, you know, the value of housing or real estate in the United States, you know, maybe it's tracked, more or less close to that, right? And then rent, you know, has followed, the value of real estate. And all, you know, I mean, if the economy is to keep going, all of that has to go down, right? The houses actually aren't worth that much. Landlords actually can't get that much money out of people because there's just the value of everything has been reduced. And so, you know, what we're seeing is a kind of grand attempt to renegotiate this. Or, you know, we could just, you know, not pay rent forever. But that's what the employers and the landlords and the governors understand is that they have to kind of renegotiate all of these bills, because there just isn't money, right? It's the same thing you do when a, you know, corporation goes insolvent, it declares bankruptcy, and you see how much blood you can wring from the stone. And that's basically, you know, what they're going to do. And the eviction moratorium is part of that. They realize people aren't going to be able to pay. So they'll give people, a breather and then try to renegotiate it on the other end. And that's what the landlord associations are already saying, like telling people not to, you know, not to go hard so that they can then, you know, get something when things go back to normal. But who knows if things are going to go back to normal? It's probably not going to be the old normal.
We're going to switch gears and talk about kind of like what this means for, as you said, emancipatory struggles. And beyond mutual aid organizing, there's a push right now for rent strikes to break out on April 1st and then going into May 1st. There's also a set of five demands that have been really popular that calls for everything from prisoners to be released to free healthcare, suspension of rent, and so on. And it's interesting to me that, you know, during the 2008 crash, kind of the struggles that came out of it, whether it was the student occupation movement or the Occupy movement, it seemed that there was a real critique of demands. And this time it seems there's kind of an embrace of those demands. And I'm just curious, you already kind of spoke to this, but do you have any thoughts about that kind of tension, I guess.
I do. And I've been, you know, I've been thinking about the question of demands for a long time, you know, partly because I passed through that moment of demandlessness and, you know, was temporarily, I think, seduced by a certain understanding of it that I no longer think is right. You know, what I come to realize is that demands are sort of organic to social movements, right? There's a problem and there's a form of suffering. And then there's action taken in response to that. And the demand is sort of implicit within that action. And, you know, so having a conversation about whether to have demands or not is really, I think not that interesting. And you can't just make up a new demand. It's not like people just sit around and think, okay, what's the demand now? The demand has to be kind of organic to a particular moment. And that's the case with the kind of rent strike demand right now. It's not whether there's this need. It's a question about how to articulate it and how to organize it, right? And, you know, it's not a conversation. And so it's already here. And, I think, you know, the question of should we have demands or no demands is now entirely irrelevant to everybody's lives because they recognize there's this need. And the landlord class is already mobilizing around that in response to it. And, you know, and the state is already mobilizing in response to it and making articulations. So, you know, that's going to unfold one way or another. And, you know, the question is sort of how the things that people might do and say now will impact that unfolding.
Do you think there's any big lessons from history that we can draw from the post 2008 crisis struggles, you know, whether it was the Wisconsin occupation, the student occupation movement, Occupy, do you think these struggles kind of offer us any big lessons for what we're going into right now?
I'm not really sure. I think that there's a spirit from that moment, that is, built around kind of gathering and massifying people. And, this moment is so radically opposed to that. It's almost the opposite of it. But, for that reason, I think there's a deep connection, right? And I think that as so many people kind of are isolated and under some form of kind of social distancing regime, whether voluntarily or imposed, you know, it's a moment to kind of really think about those moments of radical togetherness. And then, you know, also I think the lesson of that series of events and those political sequences, whether it's the Arab Spring or Occupy or whatnot, is that history happens, and we don't get to really choose the conditions of our struggles. And, you know, this was sort of thrust onto the world at a moment that feels very inopportune in so many ways. It effectively iced out a number of kind of really important struggles all over the world. Right. And change them. And, these are the conditions we have. And I think it just feels like so many of the conversations are radically different now than they were 4 months ago. And that's also how, you know, 2008 and that kind of unfolding sequence felt. It happened much more slowly. But we are now into, you know, what is arguably a kind of entirely new, political sequence. And, I think, you know, I think the big lesson of 2008 is that it happens and people should really be just kind of humble, and be willing, to see things really change and be willing to really evaluate, their own ideas about things, reevaluate. We could start a riot. We can 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 start a riot.
man. I like guzzling the apple tan. I like battle hand in hand.
Of kind of just like this new sequence, I mean, we have seen like already like there's stuff happening across the prisons. There's, you know, as we speak, there's hunger strikes. There's actually been a wave of like walkouts, wildcats, and work stoppages, everything from in the audio industry to Amazon. There's just been a lot of different kinds of workers that have been taking action because they don't want to go into work and be exposed to the coronavirus. Obviously we're seeing this explosion in mutual aid, but I'm curious, you know, like with, you know, more like different kinds of workers being labeled, you know, essential for the economy and like their role in the decreasing amount of people that are active in supply chains. I mean, do you think that this, points towards the future of the disruption of those supply chains and the possibility for strike activity to, you know, strike a real blow?
I do. I do think that militant actions by workers in these kind of essential areas are going to happen. Those workers are going to have a lot of leverage because, you know, they're essentially being sacrificed and put into deeply unsafe conditions so that the economy can stay running. And that's awful. And this whole label of what's essential and non-essential really needs to be thought about. You know, why is it that certain people, are asked to kind of bear the brunt of this virus, so the rest of us can kind of sit home and go to the shop every other day. And, you know, that's a question that we need to have. And I think that, to really have that, you know, that's a conversation we need to have. And to really have that conversation, you know, there has to be a kind of engagement with worker self-activity, in these sectors. So, you know, I think that the healthcare industry right now is just a site of power, on a site of struggle. And, you know, while workers there probably can't strike fully right now for obvious reasons, I think that people should really kind of amplify their power in any way they can, because what's happening now where, you know, nurses and doctors and other people working in hospitals are being, you know, sort of asked to, you know, meet this huge number of coronavirus cases without any kind of personal protective equipment whatsoever. It's just, it's appalling. And, you know, they should be in revolt, and we should be in revolt for them. And just as we should be, you know, in revolt that people are being kept in prisons as, you know, coronavirus continues to COVID-19 continues to spread there.
Like, I can almost see, for instance, like with cities, like just, service workers, you know, people that are working in the gig economy, people living to paycheck to paycheck. Like, if they're just pushed out, in many ways, that's going to just be a continuation of what we've already been seeing over the last decade or so with gentrification and the housing crisis. You know, I see a lot more people like joining the ranks of, you know, people that are houseless, sleeping in their cars, you know, just kind of getting by. Maybe some people like, getting jobs at places like Amazon, which are really booming during this time. And it seems like all of what we're seeing right now, like if we come out of this and there's no really, any sort of big reorganization of the way that the world works, we're going to see the trajectories of automation and a lot of these other kind of economic factors just kind of continue forward.
Well, I, you know, there's so much I don't know right now. And so it's, you know, really impossible to answer that question. But I will say that I, you know, think in general, crises of capitalism are moments where capital is concentrated and centralized, because it's typically the smaller and medium-sized firms that go bankrupt. And then the big companies are given, you know, life support by the state, and they have the capacity to hang on and then buy up all of the other bankrupt firms, or reorganize an industry around their power. And so that's certainly what we're going to see happen with those sectors, that are in the essential, you know, part of the economy. So, you know, grocery stores and Amazon, and the kind of logistics sector, there'll be a massive amount of kind of concentration and centralization of capital there. Of course, you know, I mean, if it becomes a larger political or economic crisis, it could reverberate through those sectors in different kinds of ways. But I absolutely expect, you know, Amazon to be, you know, the number one grocer coming out of this, right? And for a kind of new regime of online grocery and food delivery to come out of this. I mean, it's already moving in that direction. So that's not good, because that just, you know, continues the kind of reorganization of our lives to the benefit of, you know, employers. And, you know, so yeah, it's likely that the kind of gig economy, sharing economy model of Amazon will only kind of intensify as this crisis persists. And many sectors could stand to do very well. You know, you're seeing already the stock prices of some firms really moving in a direction opposite to everything else. So, you know, capital can still accumulate counter to the trend.
There's a lot of talk of UBI. We brought it up a little earlier ago. I'm just curious, you know, your thoughts on that. I'm sure some people right now obviously would welcome this as a, you know, as a lifeline. I'm just curious, like, is UBI something that we should, like, actively push for, or should we be more critical of it?
I think that I think that the emergency UBI cash payment right now makes so much sense that it's going to happen. I mean, you have a situation where people can't leave their houses and yet need to pay for things. They can't work. And I think this, you know, that even the Republicans recognize this. So I think the only discussion to be had is about what kind of payment it's going to be, right? Is it going to be for everybody? Are you going to be able to access it without a, you know, without a social security number, or, you know, are you going to only be able to access it through the kind of tax system, or is it going to be kind of distributed in some way where anybody can get a kind of unique number and get the money? And, you know, if I thought that it was possible to kind of expropriate, you know, commodities and everybody's needs directly without, you know, the monetary system right now, I would think maybe it would be better to do that. But there's an immense amount of need. And, you know, it's simply not, that's the only way people are going to eat. So I think, you know, it's a bit ridiculous to talk about it, to make it into a yes, no question. It's going to happen. There's a massive amount of need. The question is whether it's going to be restricted to, you know, people who pay taxes, or whether it's going to be, you know, and so I think that, yeah, politically it makes sense to kind of try to, generalize that and disaggregate it. You know, you could also just say that there could be, you know, money given to, I don't know. Yeah, I think at this point, it makes more sense to just try to kind of change the conversation around it, because the Republican version is, I mean, it's going to be like $2,000 to, you know, everybody. It's going to be gone in a flash. And they're probably going to end up having to do something else. So the question would be, how would you take that money and, you know, force it to be a bit more free flowing? I think that would be what we try to do.
Well, I wanted to turn now again. It seems like the Bernie Sanders campaign has definitely come to a close. From my understanding, he's kind of brought his forces back in, and they're not asking for money anymore. I'm just curious, do you think that the end of his second campaign, now ending in failure, do you think that will lead to a shift within the, you know, quote, anti-capitalist left? Or do you think this will just be the restart of more of the same? You know, we're already seeing people telling AOC to run in 2024. People are talking about forming a third party. Do you think that there's going to be a split and some people will kind of gravitate more towards self-organization, autonomy, and direct action? Or do you think that there's going to be just those people will continue on as they always have been, waiting for the next person to represent them?
I don't know. I don't really know. That's a tough question. I mean, it does feel as if the kind of social democratic interregnum we've been passing through for the past, you know, 3 or 4 years is now over, right? This kind of, you know, interest in the Democratic Party and trying to kind of, wrest it away from, you know, the hands of the kind of terrible people that have been directing it. I think that there's a lot less excitement about that for obvious reasons. And, but, you know, perhaps I think in this situation where Trump is facing off against state and municipal governments, there's still, a lot of things that people will end up doing, and probably a lot of kind of electoral projects that will, some people will push for. But yeah, we're now in a moment where, direct action makes a lot more sense. And where, in fact, a lot of the demands that the kind of broader social democratic, left has made are now being kind of granted, by, you know, by a panicked state. And so I think that, you know, just as everyone needs to kind of rethink their outlines and their projects now. And I'm sure that's going to get scrambled in weird ways that I can't really fathom now.
KiteLine is a weekly 30-minute radio program focusing on issues in the prison system. You'll hear news along with stories from prisoners and former prisoners, as well as their loved ones. You'll learn what prison is, how it functions, and how it impacts all of us.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
You can hear us on the Channel Zero Network and find out more at kitelineradio.noblogs.org.
Where did you get this?
Your friendly neighborhood anarchist. more of an anarchist militant.
People involved in social struggles than everybody else.
People have been waiting for some content.
Radio and show.
The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Percy Goodness.
The Final Straw Radio.noblogs.org.
You know, on this podcast, we've talked a lot about the impact of the hurricanes and the natural disasters in Puerto Rico and just how that really shifted politically in a lot of people's minds, just the nature of the state in people's lives in Puerto Rico and just how it like was an abysmal failure. I'm just curious, do you see something similar happening in the United States that people will kind of view this moment as a failure of the state to either protect them, provide, or engage in some sort of social contract? And if so, what do you think the repercussions of that will be?
I hope so, but I'm quite worried about the opposite happening, in fact. You know, I just think that it's the logic of social distancing is a problem because many people who I know and who I trust and who I care about and who I want to work with, you know, understand that we need to practice social distancing to, you know, care for the most vulnerable among us. So it's something that, you know, people, but it's in fact, you know, always imposed by the state. And so this leads to a weird situation where you've got a lot of people kind of calling on the state to act. And I think that that's really obviously disempowering. And, you know, and we already see kind of some leftists and liberals really applauding, kind of police measures and calling for a greater and more authoritarian approach. And I'm really worried about that. And, you know, especially when people are dependent upon the state for medical care and access to food, we really need to kind of, I think, any actions that people take to disarticulate care and social distancing from the state and from the state's projects is, you know, really important. You know, how do we make a kind of response to COVID-19 something that is, you know, about protecting people, but that isn't, you know, where we distinguish kind of our values from, you know, from those that are being imposed by the state. And, you know, it'll get weirder too, where you have, you know, say California maintaining social distancing, but then Trump saying, no, go back to work, right? Where the state is itself split. And I think that, that will mean it's all the more important for people to get clear about what they want, you know, and how they want to keep people safe and meet people's needs, without the police.
Last big question is, you know, something that Commune tweeted recently was that one of its chief goals was to promote different visions and different kinds of ways of life. And, I mean, it's interesting because it seems like now, you know, a vision of the world outside of wage labor and, you know, private property and some really elite owning, you know, like just this immense financial kind of monstrosity, I mean, does seem, you know, more real. I mean, and just, you know, just in my own thinking everyday life, like just thinking like, you know, how awesome would it be if like the neighborhood I live in had like, you know, a chicken coop or like a food forest or something like that, where I didn't have to worry about if the shelves were going to be stocked and things like that. I'm just curious, you know, if you want to speak to that, just kind of like that importance of envisioning different worlds and different ways of life, especially at a time when so many people are thinking about how messed up this one is.
Well, yeah, that's what we're trying to do at Commune, is to, you know, amplify stories of resistance, and, you know, people that are struggling for their lives and to live better lives. Right now I'm working on a story about these emergency brigades that have been set up in Milan that are now kind of running, you know, hundreds of people, in teams throughout the city to kind of deliver groceries and medical supplies to people that are stranded in their houses. And they have a hotline and they can now kind of, refer people to psychologists and social workers to meet some of the kind of immense need that's out there. Just people, you know, stuck in terrible situations in their houses. So that's a story I want to get out there about, you know, people that have responded to the crisis. And it's, you know, in Milan, I think it's just unbelievable. what's happened and are doing things that I think people are probably going to need to think about doing in other places. So that's the kind of thing we want to do. And just in more long term, yeah, I think it's, we're entering into a economic depression and people are going to need to find alternative ways of meeting their needs. It's time to start planting some gardens on a large scale. And because there's just going to be, you know, an immense amount of need. The entire economy has been destroyed. It's not going to come back quickly. So anything that people are doing and, you know, in thinking long term like that, I think is really worth promoting.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.